I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 8th of July. This hour of the program, in the week after nine people were murdered at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, six churches with predominantly black congregations in five southern states burned, and three of those are being investigated as arson. The fires may not be a coincidence, and they must be put in a historical context. Between 54 and 68, arsons and bombings struck nearly 100 black churches, the most infamous, of course, the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, resulting in the deaths of four young girls, and the four KKK members who plotted the attack never faced charges. There was a reemergence of church fires in the 90s. President Bill Clinton formed the National Church Arson Task Force, and Congress passed legislation doubling the penalties for future church arsons. This hour of the program, we'll be talking about the church burnings in the South and other issues relating to South Carolina and the horrendous massacre in Charleston in June. Our guest is Kevin Alexander Gray. He is a human and civil rights activist, a political organizer, writer, and speaker based in Columbia, South Carolina, author of The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama, Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. He and his younger sister were among the first blacks to desegregate the local elementary school in Spartanburg in 1968. We'll talk about that. He was on the national board of the ACLU, president of South Carolina's ACLU, played a leading role in the fight to remove the Confederate flag from the State House dome. He has worked for workers' rights, equal treatment under the law, been involved in political campaigns, coordinating Jesse Jackson's victory in South Carolina's Democratic presidential primary, and he was Southern political director for the Iowa Senator Tom Harkin's presidential primary campaign. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Kevin. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Sister Dunn. Let me make sure that I just make a couple of corrections.
Sure.
The book we have out now, and I co-edited it with Jeffrey St. Clair of Counterpunch and Joanne Vipievsky, who writes for The Nation, is Killing Trayvons, and that's Trayvons with an S, plural,
mm-hmm.
The Anthology of American Violence. And the Waiting for Lightning to Strike book is because I wrote about the Confederate flag and about the imagery and all the history of white supremacy in South Carolina. That book is getting a second look by a lot of people. And the Decline of Black Politics book is long overdue. It's a 30-year history book.
Oh, my.
Of progressive politics. Well, they wanted it to come out when Obama first got elected, and I didn't want it. I had been working on that book prior to people even knowing who Barack Obama was, and I didn't want it to be seen as just an Obama book, although, that became the big elephant in the room. How do you redo a book that you've been writing for 10 or 15 years to talk about Obama and what he's meant to black politics and civil rights politics and progressive politics? So the theme generally stays the same, I must say, but and I talk about the generation that's been supportive of Obama, but it certainly isn't just a book about Obama, and it should be out before he leaves office, and that will be great timing because, I think it's going to be a time for reorganizing, and with this new younger leadership that's stepping up and being more aggressive, and I hope it will give them some kind of context and consciousness as to what has happened before they started their period of activism.
Mm-hmm. Well, good.
And leadership. Yeah.
I'm glad it's about to be released, and it's always good to know our history, isn't it? We forget it. It is good to know. Well, let's start with these. We have a lot to talk about with you. Let's start with these church burnings. I keep getting different figures from the press. I hear there may be more than six, but there are for sure six since the massacre in South Carolina in Charleston, and three of those have been determined to be arson. Is that correct, Kevin?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. And, Now, because I actually organized some of the hearings, the congressional hearings, and I actually helped coordinate President Clinton's trip to Greeleyville back in 96, I believe it was, and bringing attention to all the church fires that were occurring in South Carolina at that period of time. We had a congressional delegation come down here, and Congressman Conyers was instrumental in calling the national congressional hearing to take testimony from church people across the South. And a lot of those fires back in the 90s were set by neo-Nazis and Klansmen. But I think, you know, there have been eight fires, I believe, since the massacre down in Charleston. A lot of those fires, I think we almost have to reserve judgment and wait for the investigations, because in the past, as I said, there a lot of the fires in the 90s were the result of hate groups. A lot of fires are opportunist church people who will set their churches on fire. And then there are acts of nature. Most people, when the fire broke out in Greeleyville last week, people didn't necessarily jump to the conclusion that the fire was because of a hate group of the Klan. We had lightning storms and a big storm that came through the area, so we had a lot of damage and a lot of some fires of homes and other such structures. So people, and a storm passed through that area, so people were apt to believe on the fire in Greeleyville that fire was due to lightning and natural causes, and I think that's what the authorities are saying caused the fire.
And yet people must be understandably jittery considering the horror that took place in Charleston and considering the history of fires, of arson and bombings by the KKK and others at many churches over the years in the South.
Well, you know, and when you go online and look up church fires, they start with Emmanuel AME Church and the fact that church was burnt down by white supremacists after it was revealed that Denmark Vesey had plotted an African insurrection in the church. So it starts there. And, you know, we're debating taking this flag down in the state.
Right.
And I've been telling people, while a lot of folk outside this state view the debate and view all the activity on the state house grounds, all the people with their rebel flags riding around town, riding around various towns with the flags on the back of their trucks, the dueling rallies. I spoke to a friend of mine who's the deacon at the church in my hometown of Spartanburg yesterday, the church that I was baptized in, and he said, yeah, on Sunday after the shooting, at high noon, a young white guy comes up to our church with a backpack saying he was homeless and looking for something to eat. And, of course, after that, what happened in Charleston, we were reluctant to let him in the church. So we took his backpack and then looked outside to make sure he wasn't with anybody, and we let him in the church. Now, my friend Erskine said, and this is a conversation we had yesterday, because I said to him, well, what would Jesus do? I'm joking about what would Jesus do if you had a homeless person on the steps? He said, well, Jesus would let them in, but Jesus might not be carrying a gun, which some of the people in the church were. And I had a friend of mine, some young folk here in Columbia, tell me the story about that's been kept really quiet here in Columbia, about two young men, white men with guns, standing out in front of the largest black church in the city the Sunday after the shooting. And, you know, everybody's trying to keep the lid down. There's a big meeting tomorrow here at the high school down the street from me with ATF and FBI and local police and law enforcement and ministers to talk about how to be alert and what to be alert for after the decision to take the flag down, if that decision is made. After that decision is made, how will people need to respond? What will people need to be mindful of? So everybody is really on edge, mm-hmm. on alert, and trepidatious about what's going to happen next here.
So, Kevin, what do people need to be mindful of?
Well, you know, it's dangerous without stereotyping people. You know, obviously, you know,
some of it is people being openly provocative. We had a young white guy in his pickup truck with a big Confederate flag on a stick or a pole on the back of his truck ride through the heart of the black community. And, you know, I...
Oops. Oh, something happened with our phone line. We'll have to reconnect with Kevin and hear the rest of that story of the white guy driving through the heart of the black community with a big Confederate flag in his pickup truck. We're talking about church burnings, but other issues as well. In South Carolina, the Confederate flag debate, the tensions being pretty high, as Kevin was saying, in Charleston and in South Carolina right now as a result of the horrendous massacre and as a result of the political debate concerning the flag that came as a result of that massacre and how to deal with what might happen should the flag completely come down, the people who still want to fly that flag, who feel that it's a part of Southern tradition. But looking at the whole history, too, which is, it's important to remember our history of the number of bombings and arsons that took place in black churches in the not-too-distant past. And so there have been at least six, maybe more than that, burnings at churches in the South since the horrors in Charleston. Three have been determined to be arson. The others perhaps causes of lightning or electrical failures, but they are being investigated. And understandably, people are on edge considering the history and considering what happened in Charleston. We're going to welcome phone calls for Kevin as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. We'll reconnect with him. We are reconnecting with him in just a few seconds, so we'll pause for a moment and return and hear the rest of that story and more stories on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We've reconnected with Kevin, who was in the middle of a story of a young white man waving his Confederate flag, having it fly from the back of his pickup truck in an all-black neighborhood. So please, Kevin, continue the story.
Yeah, and so I mentioned it to the chief of police because I said, you know, the fact that this young man thinks that he could terrorize or frighten anybody, I said, back in the 60s and 70s, it's not like everybody cowered in.
Oh, my. Well, we're just going to have to try and reconnect with our guest. We're just having problems. We're having problems with the phone line, so we're going to switch to another line. I'm sorry, everybody. We'll get to you momentarily and take your phone calls as well. If you're just tuning us in, Kevin Alexander Gray is our guest. He's a human and civil rights activist, political organizer, writer, and speaker who is based in Columbia, South Carolina. He's done a lot of political work over the years. He is a frequent guest on Keep Hope Alive with Jesse Jackson's weekend radio show. And he was involved in desegregating the local elementary school in Spartanburg, his hometown, in 1968. So we're looking at a number of issues with him, and we're trying him on yet another line. Kevin, are you there now?
I'm okay. Here now. I hope the cell phone works.
Yeah, the cell phone sounds crystal clear. All right, back to that story, Kevin.
So anyway, I'm trying to figure out where I'm at at the story. So anyway, we told the police chief, well, maybe they need to do a few more patrols to look out for that kind of thing in the community, because it's not like black people are afraid of white people, and they're certainly not afraid of a Confederate flag, and they're not terrorized like that. And to ride through the hood is inviting trouble. Either he must be armed, but if he thinks there are not people armed in the black community, he would be making a really bad mistake, especially since the massacre. I think I was telling you a story about the young white guy who came to my home church in Spartanburg.
Yes.
And on the Sunday afterwards at high noon, and, you know, said he was homeless and he was looking for something to eat. And, of course, people were trepidatious. And then there were two white young men that stood out in front of the largest black church in the city of Columbia with weapons on a Sunday afternoon
during church services. And so there are a lot of things that aren't being reported, and people are really on edge because of this flag and all the agitation of the pro-flag people, and we know that they will act out in violence. So people are really on alert, and it's not an abstraction for us. It's something that we've dealt with throughout the years, and every now and then it just sparks up, and it's a hot summer, and this is a contentious issue. And when you start talking about people's heritage, white supremacy, and racism, and skin privilege, people can get agitated.
Right. Does it surprise you at all, Kevin, that people adhere to this heritage, which should have been over 150 years ago? They should have just given up the flag after the Civil War, which is when they started flying it. The war was lost. It was over slavery. This is a whole long time to be holding on to a losing side. You would think that it would have passed by now, that people would have been embracing Abraham Lincoln and the American flag.
Oh, really? You are from Wisconsin, aren't you?
I'm from Illinois, you know, actually.
Oh, well, even Illinois. Well, first of all, I mean, I say to people that Richmond is the capital of Dixie, Atlanta is the heart of Dixie, and South Carolina is the soul of Dixie. Mm-hmm. It's the ideological home of white supremacy and racism in this country. It's where the terms interposition and nullification comes from.
Right.
It's where the whole states' rights argument comes from. It's where right to work comes from, which is basically anti-union. The whole idea of the plantation structure and capitalism and what that means, that the plantation owner is the job creator and the workers are just disposable, which is basically the underlying premise of capitalism. And when you talk about the Southernization of American politics, where the Republican Party, if it's not voter ID, it's something else. It's gerrymandering or making it difficult for people to vote and fighting progressive voting change, or it's denying people health insurance by saying they don't deserve Medicare or Medicaid if they're not working, that they're useless, that they're throwaway people. The whole idea of slavery and the language of slavery and how we debate politics in this country right now is all on the Southernization of American politics. And the idea that we live in a profoundly racist country and nobody wants to be a racist. You call somebody racist and they're like, no, I'm not a racist. Well, racism isn't about just you individually disliking or thinking another person of color is less than you. That's bigotry. Racism is about a structure and a system. And all of us are racist. We have to be conscious of that racism to deal with that racism. When you talk about racial profiling and the disparities in the criminal justice system and disparities in education, disparities in housing, and why that is, well, that's institutional racism that we all buy into. It's the prison guard, be they black or white, working in a system that, because of the war on drugs, imprisons a lot of nonviolent drug offenders. You might not think you're racist, but you're operating and making your living on a racist system. If you're a black cop beating up on a black kid because you think that kid is more violent just by the way you've been acculturated, then you're a racist. That's just the way that if you're a prosecutor working in the system or somebody working for that prosecutor that basically enforces policies that have a disparate racial effect, you're a racist. If you support the war on terrorism, And this idea that we can bomb people of color all around the world and that we are exceptional, that we're better than everybody else, well, that's racist. And that's what people need to wrap themselves around, the brains around South Carolina, with the language and the history of the state. The idea that of succeeding from the Union, or
yes,
the idea of the inferiority of races. The foundation, the ideological foundation, comes out of this state, and it gives life and breath to the politics that we practice today.
Well, it's troublesome, though, Kevin, and certainly that's true. The first shot fired at Fort Sumter, that we are 150 years this year away from that horrendous battle that divided this country, and it was over slavery. And the fact that anybody can even think of driving a pickup truck through a black neighborhood with a Confederate flag, or think that it's okay to espouse their heritage, their Southern heritage, and the Confederate flag is a part of that. Obviously, what you said is all true, but it's hard to believe that people can adhere to their side in the Civil War after so many people have died over the last 150 years. When do you?
Sure they can. Sure they can. I mean, people are that believe that black people, and they hear it every day, that black people are more violent, more prone to criminality, more apt to be lazy, like the slave. I mean, people buy into that. That's who they are. And they've, you know, since the turn of the last century, 1900s, with the rise of the cult of the lost cause and the end of Reconstruction and the redemption period, which started out of South Carolina with Pitchfork Ben Tillman, who is on the, has a statue on the State House ground. And this whole idea of Southern heritage and Southerners just rebelling against the interlopers from the North. People buy into that. You look at what's going on in the school system in Texas and changing the curriculum, and you know, just how we even deal with the subject. The folk with the Dukes of Hazzard series are complaining because they pulled the show off the air because of the car of the General Lee, and you know, people get that kind of soft sell on the flag being about rebellion, and they try to go and back into the past and insert that whole notion, no, it's not about slavery, it's about us just being rebellion,
right,
onto the history books, even though the people that designed that flag and fought that war were very clear why they fought that war. They wanted slavery extended across the country. They believed that blacks were inferior and that white males were a protected class. And for the yeoman farmer and the poor whites that went out there to fight that war, who said that it wasn't about slavery for them, well, it was kind of like folk who want to be capitalists. They support capitalism and support the 1% because in their minds they hope one day they'll be part of the 1%. The yeoman farmer hoped one day that they would have a slave or have workers or be a plantation owner. And what our culture did with the invention of the so-called category people call white was to say, you might be poor, you might not have as much as the next white man, but at least you ain't a nigger. And that's a lot of people, but still believe that.
Yes, they do. And yet we did have this moment, and tell me what it's done in South Carolina and throughout the country. We did have this moment when people could not believe the horror of what happened in Charleston, South Carolina. People could not believe the dignity with which all of the members of that congregation and people in the black community responded to this terrorist. People couldn't believe that this could happen in 2015. And by golly, they talked to a Republican governor leading a charge to take down the Confederate flag, which might be a small thing, but there is a pause. There is a conversation about some of this, isn't there?
Well, you know, yes, that's the good thing. There's been a conversation. And as I said, for a lot of us, it's not an abstraction. No question, Nikki Haley is moving the state a step forward. Now, given that she has often used the language of the Old South in denying Medicaid expansion to take place in the state, and, you know, I spoke on the steps of the State House on the 4th of July. I said, you know, now, people who didn't get health insurance who will die because they don't have health insurance, they won't die as violently as people in the basement of Mother Emanuel, but they're dying all the same, and their deaths are just as significant to the people that lose them. And, you know, while we're having this moment here in the state, it's, you know, how does it change the economics? And then there's the politics, whether or not, you know, this is Nikki Haley's last term, you know, how much of it is about her hopefully getting on board somebody's ticket and her heart. I mean, I know she she's has expressed heartfelt anguish over what happened. And she said, you know, this upset her kids. Well, it upset everybody's kids. It's not just about her kids. And so, you know, we can't just talk about taking down the flag. We got to talk about dealing with the structural issues also. And, you know, it all remains to be seen. I don't want to be the person that dials, that throws some water on the candle of hope. But, you know, people say, well, how could this young boy go into that church and kill those people? And I'm like, you know, I'm in Columbia where Fort Jackson is, and every time I fly in and out of the city, when you come into the city, you're going to be greeted by young soldiers who go off to Fort Jackson to be trained to fight and kill people. And then we think about the people that died in Afghanistan and Iraq, and, you know, how I was talking to a young veteran this morning, and he was just talking, well, no one will ever be able to come into that, in any place I'm at, and surprise me. Well, I'm not ready. And I said, you did a number of tours in Iraq. How many people's houses did you kick in the doors? And they were totally unsurprised and unable to respond. So, for me, yes, it's tragic. Clemente was someone I knew. He was a great guy. But the idea that we forget as a country that we are responsible for a whole lot of deaths, that every Tuesday, although President Obama gave a wonderful eulogy, singing a song written by a slave ship captain, that every Tuesday, on Terror Tuesday, he gives people permission to assassinate people. And how many people whose names we don't know have been killed by drones? I am saddened by what happened in Charleston, but for Americans to say, oh, well, man, this is tragic, this never happens. It happens every day, and we do it.
Let's go to phone calls for you. Our guest is Kevin Alexander Gray, a human and civil rights activist, political organizer. He's based in Columbia, South Carolina. He's the author of many books, and he's been involved in civil rights movement, ACLU, for a long, long time, and politics. Let's go to Radley in Minocqua for our first caller for you, Kevin. Hi, Radley.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Thanks for your work, Kevin. That's pretty heavy what you just laid down about all the dust. Anyway, my comment is about white privilege. I grew up in Hyde Park, Kenwood, Chicago, South Side of Chicago, very ethnically diverse. Lots of friends, fathers were mentors, loved ones to me that were black people. And since then, I moved to northern Wisconsin, where it's mostly white, and I see the ignorance of people just who haven't been exposed to other people of different races and have assumptions about them. But, you know, I never really understood the term white privilege because I felt like I didn't have a racist bone in my body. And then with this whole shooting, there was a lot of outcry from the black community, anger and hurt and distrust, which I totally understand. And a commentator on NPR was mentioning that he went to some vigil or something that where a white woman went to hold his hand, and he had a hard time holding her hand, even though he knew she was there to support. He was just so angry. And it struck me like thinking, whoa, how could you assume that a white person might just be bad because they're white? And suddenly it clicked on me, that's white privilege, that I never had to think about that before. And that my black friends have to deal with that all the time. You know, just because I have this skin color, you're going to make assumptions about me. And one thing that I think white privilege probably means now that I think about it is just that as a white male in America, I walk around basically feeling like no one ever assumes anything about me. And this whole, the outcry from the black community and some of the anger towards white people is the same thing. So I just wanted to share that. And it's, you know, my heart goes out for the fight. So
thanks,
I hope
really.
We can all see that we're equal.
Thanks for the call.
You know, he made a lot of really good points. When I spoke on Sunday, I said, let me give you a really good example of white skin privilege. In McKinney, Texas, at a pool party, police come in, and, of course, officer, I think his name is Casebolt, throw the 14, 15-year-old girl on the ground after pulling his gun out on a teenager and sits on her.
Right.
When Dylan Roof was arrested outside of Charlotte, if you go back and look at the video, police put their guns in their holsters before they took him out the car and took him to Burger King to get a hamburger. That's white privilege. Now, you said something earlier, and you know, because about the word terrorism, and I've been pushing back against use of the word terrorist with Dylan. I would opt for murderer, because the use of the term post 9/11 has meant a lot of things, different things to different people. To the Muslim community, the term is a racist term used to justify fighting that war on terror and having an assassination program and a drone program and why we were in Iraq and Afghanistan and this whole endless war on our rights with ENDA and the Patriot Act. So I've pushed back on use of that term to say we ought not, as progressives, and I consider myself progressive, seek to expand the use of that word domestically. An example I use is to say in South Carolina we have a lynching law. And most of the people, and that law was probably put in place by well-meaning people thinking, well, you know, lynching black people, we're going to come down hard, we're going to, you know, give you extra punishment or an extra fine or extra time in jail if we cite you for breaching that law. But the majority of people that have been charged under that law have been black people. And I'm willing to bet if we start talking about expanding the use of the word terror, then, and when I even was online this morning and somebody was talking about crime, and I think it was Philadelphia or Chicago, and they were talking about these kids are domestic terrorists. And your rights go out the window with that. So, you know, I'm a civil libertarian. I believe in one standard of law. Charge that young man with 9 counts of murder. I'm opposed to the death penalty. I don't think that's revenge. And like the people, the family members of the slain stood up in that courtroom and said, we will not be eaten up with bitterness and hate. Our house is built on love. And that's where we, for me, I don't want to sound squishy and weak or kumbaya.
It's okay if you do.
But you know, that's where we need to be going as a nation, to emerge from fear and to emerge from this idea of revenge being a substitute for justice. And the idea for the people that are angry, it's just like the drug. I give another drug war example where blacks are disproportionately charged and given harsher sentences than whites for like crimes, and the cry goes out for the black community. We need to punish white people. We need to punish them as much as black folk are getting punished. No, we need to lessen punishment. We need to have fair sentences, and we need to dial back on the war on drugs. It ought not be equal injustice for all, but equal justice for all. So, you know, and these are the outgrowth of the tragedy in Charleston, is that we can talk about some of these things, that if we're going to have a conversation about race, let's understand what the terms mean, what racism means, what white supremacy means. President Obama spoke in that church and he kept saying racial problem. No one wants to say racism, the racism problem. We got a race problem. No, we got a racism problem. And so, you know, let's have the honest discussion about the history, and that the history isn't a land of immigrants. It's a land of immigrants and descendants of people who were kidnapped.
Right.
And even when people talk about here taking the names off of monuments or taking the names off the streets, well, do you give up your last name? Because Reverend Pinckney's name comes from the name of a wealthy plantation owner. The Middleton name, I think, is Dr. DePayne Middleton, doctor. The name Middleton is a plantation name. The name Hammond is a plantation name. Calhoun, so Jefferson, Washington. We have the black people have the names of their slaves, owners or masters that they carry with them, in the same way that President Obama led people in singing a song that was written by a slave ship captain. Yeah. That, you know, that's psychologically, I don't think that white America ever thinks about that, that that's what we carry every day.
Radley, thanks for your call. Corey in Watertown, hi. Corey, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to say, you know, I got to preface it with that I'm a white man from Wisconsin. I'm 53 years old. I don't consider myself prejudiced. But regarding the flag, I would say my opinion is that this is a country of freedom of speech. If somebody wants to fly the flag on their own personal property and their own personal level, that's up to them. But it should not be flown by any state, federal, or local government because of its history that we all know is to be true instead of somebody's personal beliefs.
Kevin, is it okay?
You won't get any, you know, I said, I'm an ACLU guy.
Right.
You won't get any argument with me about that, and that was the issue. Back in 2000, when I was president of state ACLU, we were trying to file a First and 13th Amendment challenge to the flag on the dome when the boycott was introduced. And the boycott kind of took off, and the National didn't have, I'll say it, the National didn't have the stomach to take on that lawsuit. And now, as we see with the lawsuit or the Supreme Court decision on the Texas license plates, we probably would have prevailed. But it was worth making an argument. We were trying to argue that that flag had ideological content and it represented compelled speech flying on the dome. And why should we pay taxpayers who are opposed to that pay for the maintenance of well, some might call it treasonous, are just immoral symbols. And so that, you know, I agree with the caller. You can fly from your house. You can put it on your bumper sticker. You can wear it on a belt buckle. You can wear it on the T-shirt. I've defended kids wearing Malcolm X T-shirts in high school and Confederate flags to support their right of free speech. As President ACLU, we've supported the Klan marching on one side of the street and NAACP on the other, opposing and for or supporting that flag in Myrtle Beach on the same day. What you personally, I believe is freedom of speech. I don't believe it ought to be banned. I don't believe in banning things or running things off the ground. At least, you know, I used to joke about the flag flying on the state house or on the ground that it was truth in advertising. You knew the kind of people you dealt with, the history of the flag, what the designers of that flag and the people behind that flag said that flag was about is real clear in history. And unless you're ignorant or just a rabid racist, the history is clear on what that flag was about and what the Civil War is about. And so, you know, and I think that we stop giving people the benefit of the doubt and or the benefit of their ignorance when they talk about, well, it's just a sign of being rebellious. Well, you didn't decide what it was. The people who designed it decided what it was. And if you adopt it, that's who you are. And deal with it.
Thank you so much, Corey, for your call. If you don't mind, reminisce with me for a while, because I found it interesting in reading your resume, Kevin, that you and your younger sister were among the first blacks to desegregate your local elementary school in Spartanburg in 1968, which was not all that long ago. How hard a thing was that, or were you warmly welcomed?
Oh, well, you know, I tell people these days, the most trouble you would have would be with the parents, but the... Our transition wasn't that bad. It really wasn't. And I'm actually still in touch with many of some of the teachers that are still alive. I still talk to them from time to time. And a lot of the young folk that I went to school with, because, you know, we were the first, but by the time we got to junior high and high school, the schools were pretty much integrated, although we were still in those so-called traveling sections where we were less likely to have other black students in the class with us. But I still have most of those folks as friends, and you know, Spartanburg's not a big city. We all know each other. So, you know, we had the struggles. I remember the first time that I probably got suspended from school was fighting over the Confederate flag.
Really?
Uh, I, You know, a friend of mine stopped by from Spartanburg yesterday, and we were talking about it. When Judd Janiwis wore his Confederate flag on the back of his dungarees jacket into a group of black kids waiting on the bus. We all used to congregate behind the gym by the high school radio shack, and the buses would pick us up, and black folk would be in their corner, and white folk would be in their corner, and they'd have music blaring out over the loudspeaker. And Judd Janiwis waded his way through a group of black kids with his Confederate jacket. And Judd's mother ran the little country store probably about a mile from my house. You know, back then you had the little country store and you had the gas station on the corner.
Right.
And the bus. Yeah, so we knew Judd, but that didn't keep people from taking that jacket off of Judd. So, you know, you had that kind of stuff. And we walked out, and because of just more so in high school than junior high school. But for the most part, what has happened in my life because of that experience is that, you know, I was at that in an all-white environment during the day, and then I had to go back to an all-black environment in the afternoon, in the evening, to go home. I've been kind of, I don't want to sound like an interpreter of the drums, but, you know, I've been going back and forth between those two communities all my life and being involved in expressing, you know, for the white folk that know me and want to have the kind of conversations that we're having on this radio show about race and about how do we move forward with the black community that, you know, it's not getting a whole lot even now as far as economic development. Things are always tight. But, you know, I've been one of those people that have those conversations that beyond the politics.
Right.
And so it readied me for that. And as I said, it wasn't that bad. I mean, I remember one or two fights, but, and maybe, you know, you're called nigga every now and then, but you know, it wasn't bad. It was actually, it shaped my life.
Hmm. Kevin Alexander Gray is our guest, human and civil rights activist, political organizer, writer, speaker. He's based in Columbia, South Carolina, and he's the author of several books and edited has some books as well. He has been with the ACLU for a long time, been involved in political campaigns, was on the national board of the ACLU, president of South Carolina's ACLU, been involved in Jesse Jackson's, coordinated actually, his 1988 South Carolina Democratic presidential primary victory. And he's with us this hour, too. We started with the church burnings, but as you can tell, we've gone many directions subsequent to that. There's a lot to talk about. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll be looking at a number of issues, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, the gap between the rich and the poor. We've talked about that for years now. Bernie Sanders' economic message and why he seems to be gathering large crowds. We'll look at the economic platforms of various people, many people who are running for president and more. Something's going on with China's money today. We'll talk about that. All of that coming up tomorrow with David K. Johnston at 1 o'clock. Returning to phone calls for our guest this hour, and James in Madison. Thanks for waiting, James. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I'm on a cell phone. And, I came across a young African-American attorney trained from Harvard who has an initiative. I think it's called Equal Justice Initiative, somewhere in Alabama. And he talks about transitional justice and truth-telling, which has not happened in this country. The Nazis, after Germany, we, the United States and other powers, made sure the Germans went through this to denounce and recant everything related to Nazism and to tell the truth. South Africa did it with truth and reconciliation. And if you look at all the indignities, I will stop only at 1948, and in the lives of black Americans in this country today, all the indignities, no civil rights, in 1948, the federal government actually passed a housing law and wrote out blacks out of this. Imagine how much wealth whites were able to build, were able to get into these houses,
yes,
were able to get to this point. We have not told the truth. We have not reconciled. We have not transitioned. That's why this young man, Mr. Rowe, still have these ideas in his head that blacks, all the inhumanity, you go back to lynching, you go back to Jim Crow, you go back to slavery itself. There has not been any truth. We have not been told ourselves the truth. We have not gone through any reconciliation.
Hmm. Kevin, would you agree? And if so, what do we do about that?
I absolutely agree. And see, the problem, you know, if you even talk about restitution and reparations, people just dismiss that. And of course, there's this attack on affirmative action, and which is conservative reparation. But it's the idea in this country that black people are non-contributors, that they don't bring anything to the table, that we're a drain on this country, when we all know, when any economist would tell you, who, if he's truthful, that slavery was the linchpin of modern capitalism. Everything this country has now was built on the backs of people who were kidnapped. Kidnapped. This isn't the land of immigrants. It's the land of immigrants and kidnappees, descendants of kidnappees. And that's something that people need to absorb. And what that has done, the chattel slavery, no restitution or reparations after the war, Jim Crow, state-sponsored segregation, and state-sponsored discrimination, banks that wouldn't lend people money, not having property to pass down, to accumulate wealth, all that matters. All that matters. And so the idea that there are politicians that run on the idea that blacks are somewhat inherently lazy and criminal, well, that's the same old argument that the slave master sitting up on the porch or sitting in his study, that's the same attitude he had toward the slave in the field. And so we have to have that kind of discussion. Now, let me go back before I get too far away from it, because you mentioned Jesse Jackson's campaign, and it was a caucus.
Okay.
It was a caucus.
Okay.
And that's important, because we won where we had to organize 25 to 30,000 people to come to a meeting on a Saturday. And after Jackson won the caucus is when the power structure changed it to a primary, thinking they would make it difficult for another black to win a statewide office or won a statewide Democratic contest. And of course, with Obama winning, of course, he disproved that. But part of it is because we put people around the state, either working the polls or working with the Democratic Party or working in precincts as captains. And that was the significance of that campaign in fighting structural racism and how we got to the president being able to win this state back in 2004, I believe it was.
All right, we have about a minute left, so everybody will have to be quick, meaning you, Al. I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. In Land O'Lakes, hi.
Hi. Thanks for squeezing me in.
Sure.
I don't know if you remember Rod Serling's Twilight Zone about the black and white people versus the white and black people. If the black was on the right side, you were cool, but if it was on the left side, you weren't cool. You weren't accepted. So I think that fear is at the base of this. It isn't just in the United States. It's worldwide. It's the Sunnis. It's the Shians. It's the Latvians. It's the Russians. And I think people like Donald Trump use this, and he knows he's polling third in the GOP because he's using fear.
Thank you very much, Al, for your call. It's all the time we have. Kevin, I hope you'll join us again. I'm really interested in your thoughts about the president and the African-American community and lots of other issues, sir. Thank you for your time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Kevin Alexander Gray, our guest this hour from South Carolina, where he is a human and civil rights activist and has a lot on his plate. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this interesting hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls. We have news coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio. And then we will continue and talk about recent college graduates' post-career paths.